Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how.
And so part of me was just saying, can you just tell us no, and then we can move on. We had a lot of other things we had to do. And when he called, he said, I just want to thank you. You guys are a first-class organization, but I thought we were done, right? That's it. That's usually the way to let a team down. And so I was ready to say, hey, thanks for thinking of us. But he said, I'm coming to you guys. I'm coming to the Warriors.
Yeah, and you can hear me too?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I pretty much just have notes that we're going to run through. It's not anything so, intense that, I need to just, run it by you or anything. It's pretty,
That's
basic
fine.
Questions. Some of it's going to be, breakdown, but mostly I just want to get your opinion on stuff.
Okay.
All right,
well,
great.
I'm good at that. That's easy.
Man, I'm too good at it too. Recently, I had this guy from Celtics Beat on, because I'm doing these team previews. It's this guy, Larry H. Russell, and I love him, but oh my god, those Boston sports guys can talk forever. we kept getting into these head-to-head things. It was great. I mean, it was hilarious. It was good radio, or I guess good podcast, but...
Yeah, well, I used to do talk shows where I didn't have any callers, so I can talk, for 8 minutes at a stretch when I have to also, so I'll have to... and try to not do that.
I with the whole podcasting thing, the great thing is you pre-record it, so I sometimes just call myself. I don't really do that though. But anyways, this is as good a time to start as ever.
Okay,
thanks for listening to Almighty Ball and the Almighty Podcast, and welcome to the San Francisco Warriors, Golden State Warriors, not the Oakland Warriors anymore.
They've never been the Oakland Warriors, actually.
Yeah. let's go with Golden State. So this is our team preview for the Golden State Warriors, and I'm here today with John Cannon. So, John, just so the listeners know that you're qualified and that you're great at what you do, I know that you are, but they might not. Go ahead, say what you do, where you post, where you write, what you've done. And end it with your Twitter @.
Okay. So I currently am writing, I shouldn't say currently, because I'm not going to be writing much during the off season, for the Comeback Media Group, and that is thecomeback.com, and then their NBA site, crossoverchronicles.com. I am a veteran of the sports talk radio wars, actually from long enough ago that you could actually talk about sports on sports talk radio, really, yeah. Really long time ago. I used to do pregame, halftime, and postgame TV for the Phoenix Suns. My first year there was the year after they went to the finals.
Okay.
And I got to watch the declination of that proud franchise, including two brutal series losses to the Houston Rockets. The years that the Rockets won the championships, they beat the Suns both times, and one time they were down 3-1, and the Suns lost game 7 at home.
They had a good draft, though. Might be on the up and up.
They did have a good draft. Their problem office generally is awful, and that's going to be hard to overcome.
Yeah,
with a few good draft picks. So I'm a native of the Bay Area. I'm a native of San Francisco. Grew up rooting for the Rick Barry Warriors. Actually, I started rooting for the team when Barry was playing in the ABA, and then he came back to lead them to the championship in '75. And that was one of the great moments of my young life. And then 40 years later, they did it again. And 41 years later, they lost in a crushing fashion, just like they did in 1976. So I've written about all of that kind of stuff. And now they're what they are, and who knows what they are, but it ought to be pretty good.
You could call 2016 a crushing loss, I think.
Yeah. And that was as, you know, that was as crushing as they come. Although I would put 76, you know, right up there. And briefly, they were very similar to the 16 team in that they won the championship the year before and came back, improved their record dramatically. They went from 48 wins to 59, which was a franchise record until the 15 Warriors. And they were winning games by 20 and 30 points. They were really dominant. And then they lost a 7-game series to the Phoenix Suns, who were easy to overlook because they didn't have a great record. In fact, I think they were like 42-40, but they had at one time been like 13-20. So they had a pretty good second half, and they just kind of caught fire at the right time. And it wound up a game 7 in Oakland where the Warriors never lost, and they lost. And
yeah,
they got into chemistry problems with Barry, Rick Barry, and Gus Williams, who was the rookie point guard. And
he was always the less lovable of the two Barrys.
Well, there. How many Barrys are there? There's 4 Barrys.
I guess of the two Barrys that get a lot of playtime on NBA TV, maybe that's what I meant to say, but well, yeah. Rick, oh, wait, okay, so Rick Barry,
Rick's the dad.
Jack Barry,
right.
John Barry.
Scooter played at Kansas, and okay. Then I think...
Well, darn, I mean, either way, you know, we are here today to talk about the Warriors of now, though, so I'm going to press on to that, and I think that the reason why it wasn't a crushing defeat is because, you know, when I was going into these finals, it was really weird for me to like watch them lose in game 7 because I'm not used to watching this iteration of the Warriors team lose. So I figured it out. You know, like Joe Lacob said, right? This organization does everything perfect, and it was the perfect thing to lose to beat OKC, right? And have them really show off what their big problem has been since Kevin Durant has been there, right? Which is that they sort of fall apart at the end and then go on to game 7 and lose in the finals so that Kevin Durant feels like he needs to come. And it was all planned light years ahead, just like Joe Lacob said.
It looks like it. It really, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I remember the night of game 7, I was on Fox Sports Radio as a guest talking about it. And I had been on for 2 seasons with those guys. I mean, I was on, you know, literally every week, every weekend for 2 seasons. And they asked me about Durant, and I said, well, now the door's open. You know, if they win that game, then Durant's not going there. But now, absolutely. And I just to jump into that, I think that people who view Durant as a championship chaser are really missing the boat.
I totally agree.
Yeah, I think this is about him wanting to be part of something positive, joyful, where people aren't paying attention to how many points they score and how many MVP awards that they win. And he's never had that in what is 9 years in Oklahoma City and Seattle.
Yeah, absolutely. And to me, another big part of it is that, you know, all of the arguments sort of fall apart after further scrutiny, or you pull a thread and it falls apart because it's like, well, what are you going to do? Not try to lose? Like, where are you going to draw that? Or not try to win, rather? Like, where are you going to draw that line where you're chasing a ring, or where are you just going to go to be dominant? Like, when is it organic? When is it not? It's just all of these reasons why it's bad that he's done it to me, like, don't hold weight. But then stuff like, you know, he wants to be happy, like what you said. Like, he wants to have a good time. Like, there's no loose thread to pull there. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think as the facts surrounding the meeting came out, and first of all, the fact that the Warriors got all 4 of their other starters there, plus all the
– that is huge.
All the poobahs. Russell Westbrook didn't even go when OKC was pitching him.
Right.
Russell Westbrook. So that meant – and he said at the press conference, that meant a lot. When all those guys showed up, he was really surprised, and it meant something to him. And then the fact that he – and the strange thing about this, Chris, is it all always comes back to Steph Curry.
Yeah.
It, you know, and that's the people don't understand this guy's reach and the magnitude. And here's the story that the way I will tell it from how I've read. I mean, I obviously wasn't there, but in Turkey in 2010, Curry was a second thought add-in bench guy on that team. He was a very young player. He got garbage time minutes, and he was really there as a future, as a guy they thought, hey, this guy might be good someday. Let's give him a little international experience and see what happens. And, well, Andre Iguodala, who was a star at right. that time, noticed that Curry was always in the gym after practice, always working. And he started to work with him. And then Kevin Durant joined him. And those three guys developed a real bond playing basketball, going to chapel. And
yeah,
and
religion is a big part
together.
Of it.
And then in 2013, after Dwight Howard basically turned down a sign-and-trade deal with the Warriors, because who wanted to go to the Warriors in 13? Andre Iguodala agreed to sign as a free agent from Denver. Now, Denver had just lost to Golden State. Very ironic. Denver had just lost to Golden State in the playoffs, and he had this relationship with Curry. And he said in his press conference, Steph Curry's one of the big reasons I'm here. I want to play with this guy. He's great, a great player. He's a great guy. He works hard. He's exactly what you want in a teammate. So without Curry, they don't get Iguodala. And none of this happens without Iguodala.
So have you heard the story of how, you know, you said you were with or you followed the Phoenix Suns for a while, and that was the team that you were reporting on for a while. And at the time that Steph Curry was coming out of the draft, he was being profiled and steadily chased by one of the premier front office guys there, who I think Steve Kerr was actually the general manager at the time. And so he had Steph basically cornered, right? He was keeping him and charting him out using all these different analytics, including one of his teammates. I knew what his...
At Davidson?
Yes, at Davidson. Whatever. I don't want to just have you sit there while I look for this. But anyways, he had a teammate on Davidson, right, who was so bad at catching Steph Curry assists, right, that Steve Kerr decided while he was, you know, looking for recruits to have them track this kid, Steph Curry, at this college that his teammates were terrible, right? And every time he made a pass to one of his teammates that should have ended up in a score if he had good teammates, right? Huh. It was called he called it a I can't remember his name, but let's say his last name was Johnson. Every time he had an assist to one of his teammates that his teammates screwed up, they called it a Johnson, right? So as the NCAA year was going on, Steve Kerr would go in and we'd ask the draft guys, hey, how many Johnsons did Steph Curry have today? And they'd be like, he had 12. And he's like, man, this kid's going to be the next Steve Nash, right? So even the coach, right, is perfectly and finely tuned to be there to be coaching this kid. And, I mean, he had an offer, as I'm sure you know, to go coach in New York, but he decided to go to Golden State, which, as you also mentioned at the time, was in a lot of ways the laughingstock of the NBA.
Well, not at that time, because they had...
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. I mean,
when he took over, you know, and there was so much... I mean, let me talk about Steve Kerr for a minute.
Please.
And I can talk about Steve Kerr for a really, really long time, because he's special. And if you want to know about Steve Kerr, get John Feinstein's book called A Season Inside. John Feinstein is just a national book writer.
Okay.
And he wrote the book on Bobby Knight, A Season on the Brink.
Okay.
That got lots of acclaim, and it was a great book. And it actually, the irony about Bobby Knight was the book actually made you kind of understand and even like Bobby Knight. And Bobby Knight hated the book and hated Feinstein, never talked to him again, gave him all kinds of access. And then he was really mad that Feinstein wrote in the book that he used swear words, which he used all the time. Couldn't have written the book without it. So anyway, subsequent to that book, he wrote a book called A Season Inside, and it's about college basketball, and it's from like 1987 or so. And he profiles, I think four teams, and kind of goes through the whole season with these four teams. And it was Duke, Kentucky, somebody, and Arizona. Might have even been six teams, I don't remember. But Kerr was on that Arizona team. And I can't remember now if that book was written either before or after his father was killed. But he was so impressive in college to this writer, John Feinstein, who wrote a lot of this stuff. And then Feinstein wrote a much more recent book called One on One, which is kind of highlights from all of his books. And he revisits people that he interviewed in his books, and he goes back to Kerr, and they talk. And so this is, I was reading all this stuff way before Steve Kerr was the coach of the Warriors.
Right.
And I really liked him. And I talked to him a few times when I was on the radio in Phoenix, because he was an Arizona guy and he was the player rep for the Bulls. And Joe Klein, who was a friend of mine from when I was in Sacramento, knew him from the Bulls and gave me his number. And we had Steve on the air, and he was so unassuming, just like he is now.
Yeah.
Very easy to talk to and would actually tell you what was going on, which most people wouldn't. So I really liked him, and they hired him. And I thought, wow, that's a great hire. I liked watching him on TV doing his thing. And he had to slog through so much crap around the Mark Jackson firing. It was incredible.
Because God.
Race thing, hire a guy that's never been a head coach. The improvement in games that Mark Jackson had, and people were just really willing to ignore the fact that the team had no offense.
Right. I mean, it was just sort of, you know, Joe Lacob has been sort of made fun of for being, you know, Joey Lightyears, because he made that comment about being so far in front. And he really was just looking at the numbers and looking at the court, and it wasn't panning out. He was like, you know, this team fundamentally has all of these three-point shooters, including one who can shoot off the dribble from 30 feet away. Why isn't this coach able to utilize the players like this? And, you know, even beyond that, there's just so many stories about him being poisonous. So,
oh, yes. That's the other part, is he was poisonous. I mean, they lost two assistant coaches during the season.
Right.
One was fired because he was leaving his phone in rooms where he wasn't on record so he could hear what people were saying about him. This is the atmosphere that Mark Jackson conveyed. And Mark Jackson had a terrible staff. His assistants were the lowest paid and weakest assistants in the league. And that's how he wanted it, because he didn't want to be threatened. He wanted everybody to know he was in charge.
Yeah.
And Steve Kerr came in and did the exact opposite, went out and said, look, you're going to hire whoever I want. And they said, okay. And he brings in Alvin Gentry, and he brings in Ron Adams, and he brings in Bruce Frazier, and he brings in Luke Walton, and they go from having the worst staff in the NBA to one of the best. And the guys like Festus Ezeli, who just were rotting under Jackson, suddenly blossomed. Harrison Barnes was on his way out of the league when Mark Jackson was here. And Kerr's brilliant stroke to keep him in the starting lineup with Clay and Steph, rather than have him try to lead the second unit, was just brilliant. It was courageous. It was brilliant. Obviously, Iguodala gets a lot of credit because he agreed to it. But Kerr, or somebody on his staff, had the idea, and they did it. And then the Draymond thing, when David Lee got hurt, they went to Draymond. Draymond was great, and they had the courage to not go back to David Lee when he came out. And again, Kerr has the ability, in terms of communication, to get these guys to buy in a way that most coaches don't.
Well, and, you know, so much has been made as far as, you know, media narrative, self-perpetuated and sort of perpetuated from the outside, you know, almost mockingly at this point, as, you know, Golden State turns into this empire. So much is made about, okay, like, this is this perfect, well-run machine. They don't do anything wrong. They have all their ducks in a row. But the thing is, looking at it, even the people who are like, you know what, they were just lucky. You know, lots of teams get lucky. In fact, OKC got pretty lucky in the draft a few years in a row recently. Like, they picked guys who really landed, and as much as you can know about a draft profile, you can't really know until they're in the NBA, until their career fills out. But the thing is the difference, it seems to me, between the Warriors and between the Sacramento Kings is, you know, when they were given this player, Steph Curry, or when the Kings were given DeMarcus Cousins, the Warriors use that opportunity, right? They use every opportunity that reveals itself, and every time that they have a chance to make things better, right? They do that. And, you know, Steve Kerr is a big part of it. And you know what? Even this pitch to KD, that's a big part of it, because I just think it was so well executed, down to that conversation that Jerry West had with Durant. Have you read about, like, what they talked about?
Yeah. And I agree that that conversation was huge. I don't think it's because he was telling KD, hey, you don't want to play for a team that's not going to win a championship. Look what I did. I played for, you know, eight finals, lost seven of them. I don't think that was it. I think it was the fact that Jerry West, the logo,
right,
was part of this organization, an integral part, not a figurehead, not a ceremonial, and that he was calling Kevin Durant to share this with him, I think meant that he was going to a great organization, because he's leaving a pretty good one, right? Let's be honest. Oklahoma City's a good organization.
Well, see, I agree to certain extents. They're definitely not a bad organization, but I think it's more that he's leaving a shaky situation and going to a silver platter.
But he doesn't want to leave that and go to another bad one, right?
Right,
he doesn't
of course. Want to
leave, because he knows that even if Westbrook left and he stayed, Sam Presti's good. And he's going to get good players in there. And he's, you know, Donovan looks like he's could be very good. And, you know, so he wasn't leaving a bad situation. Although I think the Oklahoma City would have had a much better chance to keep Durant if this was also Westbrook's year and Westbrook left. I think Durant would have stayed if Westbrook left. I think that ultimately, and I first started thinking this when I was watching them on the podium after game 7 of the Warriors series. And the reporters were trying to get Westbrook to say something nice about Steph Curry. And he wouldn't.
Right.
He just refused to.
Yeah.
And Durant was looking at him. And he wasn't looking at him like, what's wrong with you? But I could just kind of feel like, and at the time, I didn't know anything about Turkey, right? I didn't know anything about 2010 and Durant and Curry becoming friends there. And now they've been friends all this time.
Yeah.
Just thinking, you know, that's just not how you do this, dude. You lost to a guy that's the unanimous MVP. You got to give it up to him.
Yeah.
Durant just did. You know, you got to do that. And when he didn't do that, I just thought Durant sitting there going, is this the guy that I want to be next to on the court and on this podium for the rest of my career? I don't think so.
Well, so you give more credence to the idea that it wasn't a, you know, to use Kevin Durant's words, a basketball decision. You know, because I think that, you know, no decision in life is purely one thing or the other. It could have been, you know, as simple as he has a gold, you know, picture in his bedroom. And when he woke up, he saw that picture and he was like, Golden State Warriors, right? It could potentially be that. But I think that fundamentally at the basis of his decision, it wasn't stuff like chemistry. It wasn't stuff like he didn't get along with Billy Donovan. It wasn't stuff like...
Oh, no, he liked Donovan. That was,
yeah, yeah. Or
he
wanted
Scotty Brooks. Was a load both on the floor and off.
Russell?
Yeah. I think
Grant
was tired of it. On the floor and off. The unpredictability. I mean, when you watch the Warriors, as much as it looks like they're kind of making it up as they go along, there's a pattern. And actually, that was kind of their downfall, was Cleveland kind of got into their pattern and messed it up. And then they couldn't readjust, which I will, you know, go to my grave thinking was because Draymond Green missed game 5. I just, hard for me to even think went wrong. of Cleveland being the true champion that year, because they were dead in the water after game 4. And then LeBron knocks Draymond down, no call, steps over him, no call. And as Green gets up, he lashes out and he hits him, and no call. And then the NBA looks at it, and they acknowledge that LeBron, you know, should have gotten a foul for the knockdown and the step over. But if either of those had been called by Danny Crawford, who was staring at the play, then there's no punch, there's no suspension, and Cleveland goes quietly in game 5.
Sure.
And the whole thing's different. Like you said, Durant doesn't go to Golden State. Harrison Barnes stays at Golden State because Harrison Barnes had a great game 4. He was a hero. And then 5, it wouldn't have mattered what happened in game 5.
Yeah.
And he would have stayed. Bogut probably would have stayed. It would have been a chance for them to come back. And this is what I do mourn this. I have to be honest. As excited as I am to see what they can do with Durant, I mourn the fact that that same group did not get a chance to come back and make it right, to go through another season, however many wins they got, and win the championship. Win 2 out of 3 and the 2 had a bigger asterisk on it, and really, you know, cement their place in basketball history, because right now it's still an unknown. It's still an argument. It's still, they were 1-1 and nothing that happens from this point forward will affect that. It's like a pitcher that's been taken out of the game and the book's closed on him. And
well, I think the crucial elements of the team are mostly still there.
Right. But once you add Durant, it's different.
Oh, okay. So that's what you mean. Yeah.
It's because they added Durant. You know.
Okay. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
They'll never have a chance with the group they had to go back and avenge that loss to Cleveland, which I was hoping that they would get that chance.
Okay.
And, you know, I had the same problem in 2002 when the Giants lost in crushing fashion to Anaheim in the World Series. And then they fired Dusty Baker. They got rid of Russ Ortiz. I think Jeff Kent left. It was like they never had a chance to come back and try to make it right. And then it was 8 years before they got back to the World Series.
Well, you know, steering us back around towards this this idea of it being a basketball decision or not. And hey, man, I love talks like this, by the way. This was going to be a team preview type thing, which is sort of like quick hour long type things. But the bottom line is the Golden State Warriors is such a huge narrative for this offseason. And I mean, if you're down for it, this could go on for as long as you want and be like a recurring session, because we're like a 20th of the way down my notes and we're just winding around, which, like, I love the scenic route, but just FYI, that's what I've been sort of thinking this whole time.
All right. Well, I've got probably another 15 minutes in this session. And then if we want to pick it up, maybe we could do Sunday when I'm on the road.
Yeah. Well, that would actually be great. We could have that conversation, because you're going to be on the road for just 4 hours straight.
Right.
I mean, do you want to do that?
I'm not going to have the, you know,
that's
quality of my voice will not be the same. but you know, I don't know how much that matters in a podcast like it does on the radio. It's hard to get people to listen to the radio with that, but
I think it should be fine.
So that's fine. And so we can end it here, or we can go for a few more minutes just talking about.
Oh, no. We should finish setting the stage.
Okay.
But this is great. And like, this conversation's been great, but I guess we can finish it on this pretense that Kevin Durant set up where he, you know, the flag, he put the flag in the ground as, no, don't question my relationship with Russell. Don't question the organization. Don't question Oklahoma City, as opposed to San Francisco. Like, how great is it to live there, or this or that or the other? And he said, this is because of basketball, and the goal of basketball is to win. And I think that the argument is so compelling, right, that the Warriors are so much better, a situation where he is almost guaranteed now to win at least one championship. Whereas if he had returned to the Thunder, not only does his teammate have all these injury issues and no cartilage left in his knees, his teammate is up for free agency 1 year later, and he could very easily leave.
Right. And I said that from the beginning, that I felt that Durant was going to leave.
Yes.
That he had to leave. That for him to stay would have been insane. And especially, as I said, when he's looking at Westbrook on the podium and going, is this the guy? Really? And he might just, who knows what Westbrook's going to do in a year? Durant sure doesn't know. Now, if Westbrook had been willing to sign an extension this year and he would have made less money, that would have probably meant a lot.
Also, to be fair, it wouldn't have been insane. It just would have, you know, if you're making the decision for basketball reasons, like Dirk doesn't return to Dallas for basketball reasons and Reggie didn't stay in Indiana for basketball reasons. It was for legacy and stuff like that, you know, those intangible things. But it would be insane in terms of, if you're making a basketball decision, then staying in OKC was not the right one.
This year, right.
Right.
With this situation and Westbrook up and everything else, it was not the right one. So I knew he was going to leave. And then it's a matter of, where do you go? And again, I just don't think I would leave any team in the league to go play for Steve Kerr. I really would. and to play with these guys, you got these four guys, three of whom were on the All-Star team and the other one probably could have been.
The cap money means that there's a totally unprecedented once in a lifetime or once in a league time opportunity to do this, you know? Like, how do you not jump on that? Out of curiosity, even.
He could have left next year and, you know, or he could have done the 1 year and he could have done that either place. But, you know, so he would have a chance to get that money anywhere. But again, these guys make more money from their shoe contracts than they do from playing basketball.
Exactly.
I really don't think it's about the money. And I don't think it's even about, like he said, he had to say what he said. He's a classy guy. He's not going to go up there and say, you know what, I was just tired of Russell Westbrook. He wasn't going to say that. He did say that he was kind of overwhelmed by the feeling that he got from the Warriors players welcoming him, telling him, look, we want you. We don't care. It's going to mean fewer shots for us, fewer points for us. We don't care. We want you. Steph may never win another MVP award.
He probably won't.
You know, I think he still will, because I think he's going to amaze and astound. I think he's going to find new ways to amaze and astound. And people are still going to slowly come to realize that he is, man, he is it. He had bad finals.
I know that he is it. It's just, and this is perhaps an interesting place where I can let you go and we can maybe talk a little bit about you coming back on to have this chat. But I do believe that he's the thing, but part of that is, or he's the real deal rather, but part of that is this willingness to be like, you know what? I've proven that I'm an amazing scorer. It's time to prove that I'm an amazing point guard too. And if you want to win, then you do what the Warriors players did. You say, okay, you know, you're a great fit. It might hurt our individual brands. It might hurt our stats. It might unpad them a bit. We might have to pull out some of the stuffing, but, you know, we're going to win, and we're going to win a lot. And, you know, that's, I think, why he won't win another MVP, because MVP voting is just so much about, you know, that sort of fluffy stuff.
How many more assists do you think he'll get throwing the ball to Kevin Durant instead of throwing the ball to Harrison Barnes?
Oh, God. You know, I think
he could get five more a game.
They got to run it through Draymond Green. And I'm not sure how big of an X's and O's guy you are. But, you know, I'm really interested in how the strategy is going to look and how Steve Kerr is going to run this offense. But I just feel like having two shooters off ball like Kevin Durant and Steph Curry at opposite sides of the court is so horrifying if you're a defense. So I just feel like Draymond Green, you know, like count it. He's going to have double-digit assists next year. That's what
right. But well, what he will have, I think, a lot of are hockey assists.
Yeah.
I think you know, because he'll throw the ball to Steph, and the defense will react, and Steph will throw the ball to either Clay or KD, and he'll get a lot of assists. I think there are going to be a lot of assists to go around. And this is a team that, you know, that got 30 or more assists. I don't know how many times this year. They smashed the record for most games with 30 or more assists, and yet in the playoffs they couldn't do it. Couldn't get it done. So that really was, in a way, a mystery to me, but it's because we have an amazing ability, Chris, to forget about an injury as long as the guy is out there.
Yeah.
We forget.
Yeah.
That injury, go back and look at it sometime. It was horrific.
I mean, the fact that
he had just had the ankle tweak, so his ankle was wrapped really tightly. So there was no flexion in the ankle of the right leg to help take the stress of that fall. It all went to the knee.
Yeah.
And then in his second or third game back, he fell on his elbow going after a loose ball. Shooting arm, by the way.
Right.
And
we saw what that did to a guy like Kyle Lowry. Like, that is not the type of thing you want to have to happen to a shooter, you know, especially a shooter who isn't like, you know, Gilbert Arenas or someone like that, a shooter who's, you know, mechanic and, you know,
and shooting from 25 feet.
Right, right.
A small deviation in your form at 25 feet is going to create a miss.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's pick that up and we'll do more.
Yeah.
Call me 7 on Sunday. How's that?
That sounds 7 p.m. on Sunday. That sounds good. All right, great. Well, hey, it was
great,
Chris. Thank you.
It was fun.
And I'll talk to you on Sunday.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.